Thank you, Matthew, and thank you, Julia, for organizing this panel. Noted for its attention to material detail and social setting, L'Abbé Prévost's 1731 novel, Histoire du Chevalier des Grieux et Manon Lescaut, is at the same time far from being a prototype of the realist novel that will be practiced by 19th century writers, such as Balzac and Zola, whose works can be read as fictional experiments in the social sciences, demonstrating the influence of socioeconomic conditions and the physical environment on the individual, where the individual very much appears as a product of his or her environment. Prévost's novel maintains a palpable tension between the material plane of existence on the one hand, expressed by the focus on money and the hedonistic pursuit of divertissement and consumerism related to dining, entertainment, gambling, clothing, and jewelry, and the abstract, elusive quality of the main protagonists on the other hand, who appear, in the words of Jacques Proust, as depersonalized, that is to say, as allegorical figures of amour and fortune. What strikes me in this novel is the discrepancy between the concrete world of things and the elusive selves that inhabit the tale told by Le Chevalier des Grieux. This discrepancy points to a critical moment in the renegotiation of personhood when social confusion, the representation of le demi-monde, and social mixing force men and women to question the fictional notion of a properly social identity. L'Histoire du Chevalier des Grieux de Manon Lescaut depicts a newly destabilized Ancien Régime, whose moorings have shifted from the economic turmoil that accompanied the fin du règne of Louis XIV and the early years of the Regency. To a certain extent, even the world of finance and objects loses its grounding as the social environment of Manon supports the vision of an illusory and slippery world. In the new credit economy of 18th century France, value becomes attached to the prospective and virtual, the imaginary, so that the material world of goods becomes contingent upon the realization of speculative behaviors. In L'Abbé Prévost's novel, the focus on a character of noble descent who becomes déclassé through his fortuitous encounter with a beautiful commoner brings attention to the crisis of values that obscures the understanding of selfhood in the early 18th century. Although Raymond Picard and Frédéric Delofre have read Manon Lescaut as an exercise in existentialism, that is, a fictional depiction of the weight of social determinism and class ideology in conceiving subjectivity, I would like to argue that the novel engages with a thoroughly modern sense of identity, shaped by the threat of indifferentiation and narrativized by the animating principle of chance. The main object of desire in the narrative, Manon, is endowed with such an opacity that the reader will learn not a single physical property of her, in spite of being informed that her beauty is so wondrous that nary a wealthy male can resist her charms. Des Grieux perceives her to be singular, yet the reader will never exactly know why, as he is repeatedly met with abstract portrayals of the female protagonist. Manon fundamentally appears to us, as literary critics such as René Desmaurys and Sylvère Lautringer have noted, as a silence or an echo, a lacuna in the text. She is held at a distance from the narrative as her voice is filtered and mediated by the Chevalier's storytelling. Her elusive quality is suggested early on in the novel. The very first description of Manon, who's lumped with a group of prostitutes on their way to being transported to New Orleans, comes from the mouth of an archer who negates her very existence by claiming, "Ce n'est rien, monsieur, c'est une douzaine de filles de joie que je conduis avec mes compagnons jusqu'au Havre de Grâce." From nothing, Manon is then presented by an elderly woman as a thing, une chose barbare, une chose qui faisait horreur et compassion. Named both a rien and a chose, the reader may be led to wonder what kind of self Manon embodies. What do her negativity and indistinguishable character signify, apart from Des Grieux's limited and perhaps biased understanding of her character? Juliette Cherbuliez has suggestively argued that the characters in Prévost's novel attempt to distance themselves from history and society by, I quote, anchoring the self in a radical interiority and its attendant tendency towards abstraction, end quote. I would like to direct attention to the ostensible polarities of the concrete and the abstract by examining their reciprocal relationship. My working hypothesis is the following. In Prévost's semiotics, the concrete and the abstract produce rather than merely oppose one another. The mutual production of the concrete and the abstract is symptomatic, I would argue, of the unsettling of traditional hierarchical value systems and a response towards the new ambiguity of signs in a proto-capitalistic society. The social world of Manon appears to index the difficulty of grasping essences. If anything, the attributes of ideology and the material appear to exchange characteristics. Noble ideology appears commodified or somewhat cheapened, a matter of customs and conventions, and the realm of the material takes on an elusive and intangible quality. The analysis of the semiotics of wealth in Rousseau can be helpful to us here. The political philosopher's Pierre Manon's analysis of the semiotics of wealth has been helpful for my thinking here. Pierre Manon advances that in the Rousseauian perspective, the desire for wealth is an abstraction. Money is or becomes an abstract sign, fueling endless desire and deferring the possibility of satisfaction. I quote, "Le péché de l'argent, son essence funeste, est qu'il n'est qu'un signe abstrait. Or, le signe est plus pauvre que la chose qu'il signifie. Plus l'argent se multiplie, au fur et à mesure que le désir des richesses se répand et s'accroît, plus ce signe devient abstrait, chargé de représenter toujours plus de réalités qualitativement diverses. L'argent absorbe progressivement la profusion multiple du monde humain réel. Competing logics of value highlight the unsettling of social hierarchy in the world of Manon. Economic value and the value of esteem are in tension with one another, leaving what the sociologist Gabriel Daud will name valeur vérité indeterminate. Although Des Grieux will assert his superiority over Monsieur G.M., one of Manon's bourgeois wealthy lovers, by proclaiming, "Apprends que je suis d'un sang plus noble et plus pur que le tien," the ambiguous and arbitrary nature of this superiority questions the function of social difference and power in the novel. If Des Grieux asserts a power that is purely symbolic or formal as opposed to economic, the reader may be led to question what is the exact valence constituted by Des Grieux's agency. In a society where every pleasure has a number attached to it, the weight of the aristocratic notion of quality, qualité, is no longer immediately decipherable. How does the qualitative assert itself against the quantitative? How does qualité act upon the world? How does the aristocracy's attachment to a moral economy inscribe itself in a materialistic frame of reference? Much of the existing scholarship on Prévost's work has emphasized the prevalence of the economic order in the novel. Relationships are monetized and itemized, the cost of services and lodgings are carefully adumbrated, even speech is made an object of financial negotiations, as Des Grieux buys his right to speak, his temps de parole, to the captured Manon on her way to being shipped out to New Orleans. Is it possible to clearly demarcate the impact of the economic on the epistemology of selfhood? The language deployed in Manon Lescaut appears to oscillate between a tendency to conflate selves and things on the one hand and the reverse strategy of treating them as belonging to distinct regimes of meaning on the other. When relaying the perspective of the female character of Manon, the Chevalier Des Grieux has recourse to a grammar that tends to level selfhood to the plane of material things. Manon's inclinations are defined in a symmetrical structure of expression. Elle aime ses aises, mais elle m'aime aussi. When reflecting on his own perspective, however, Des Grieux borrows a chiastic turn of phrase so as to highlight a divergence and disequilibrium in each lover's attachments. Manon était passionnée pour le plaisir, je l'étais pour elle. But is Des Grieux's recognition of the difference between the orders of things and of selves self-evident? At first blush, it may appear that Des Grieux's initial ineptness in financial matters, his preoccupation with être rather than avoir, signals a fundamental difference with his materialistic lover, whose allegiance to an economic order, of substitution and exchange, is ingrained to such an extent that she applies it to herself and to other people. Manon dispatches a pretty young woman to the Comédie as a substitute for her own presence, allegedly for the enjoyment of Des Grieux. Her belief in the interchangeability of women is met with incredulity by her lover, who protests by asserting the incommensurable nature of Manon, who is, he says, incomparable, singular and irreplaceable. In other words, Des Grieux's nobility appears to assert itself through the refusal to adhere to an economic regime of impersonality governed by transactions and substitutions. Manon's lowly status could, by contrast, be grasped through her pursuit of hedonistic divertissement and obsession with material belongings. The class distinction between the two lovers is indeed upheld to a certain extent by Des Grieux himself, who interprets Manon's fear of lacking goods as a sign of coarseness to which he opposes his own refined sensibility. Elle appréhende la faim, Dieu d'amour, quelle grossièreté de sentiment, et que c'est répondre mal à ma délicatesse. Yet, this social framing of difference is incomplete, as readers will then discover that, if anything, Manon's profligate spending, her spending approximates her behavior to the habits of an aristocrat who deigns not to count the pennies in her purse. In Des Grieux, as people such as Naomi Siegel and Pierre Saint-Amand have pointed out, would most resemble a cautious bourgeois, who is eager to save his own money rather than spend carelessly. Material patterns of consumption in Manon serve to ultimately unsettle rather than confirm preconceived notions of social identity, as avoir and être reveal themselves to be in tension with one another. The constant code-switching effected in the novel could likely be traced to the dynamic nature of Paris as the site of social change. Whereas the provinces in Manon Lescaut are linked to the law of the father and fixed societal rules, Paris emerges as a floating signifier wherein gender and class appear as malleable categories subject to revision. Traditional gender roles are readily exchanged as Manon takes on the role of provider in the couple she forms with the knight Des Grieux. As she sets herself to work as a professional mistress, Manon affirms her sense of entrepreneurship and initiative, accumulating opportunities and capitals as they come along. Des Grieux slips into the idiom of entrepreneurship when reporting her actions and assets and allows himself to be financially taken care of. Je rappelais les petites acquisitions qui me semblaient surpasser nos richesses présentes. Manon's business ethos is presented in a handwritten letter whose rarity confirms onto her words the weight of a profession of faith. Je travaille pour rendre mon chevalier riche et heureux, she proclaims, while tracing her love for Des Grieux as the origin of her professional motivation. Set in a historical context where women were progressively discovering the agency conferred upon them via work, Manon Lescaut sketches out a Paris where gender lines are being blurred. Disguised as a man in order to flee from their captors, Manon does not attract attention in spite of her cross-dressing. On ne fut pas surpris de voir Manon en habit d'homme parce qu'on est accoutumé à Paris et aux environs de voir prendre aux femmes toutes sortes de formes. Manon's protean appearances hint at a social modernity whose signs require a distinct hermeneutics. David Harvey has examined the agency that prostitution and what he calls the democracy of money conferred to women in Parisian society in the 19th century, where opportunities for female labor were still otherwise quite limited. Yet the very nature of prostitution draws attention to its precarious status. Based on the short shelf life of erotic capital and the whims of male patrons, female prostitution will be described by Louis-Sébastien Mercier in Le Tableau de Paris as being at the mercy of fortune. The reversals in fortune in Manon Lescaut appear to illustrate the instability of capitalizing on elite prostitution and function to unsettle economic agency in the novel. Fire and theft quickly rob the couple of their accumulated wealth. The intrusion of the accidental, un funeste accident, cet accident, punctuates the narrative. Chance introduces unpredictable patterns of disorder. Although Aristotle had treated of the accident as an inessential secondary phenomenon that stands in contrast to human substance, in the world of Prévost, the accident appears more as a governing principle or societal law that besieges human capacity. Yet chance is difficult to grasp for its relativity and inscrutability. The theft of the couple's goods by their domestic servants can be construed as pure bad luck. Likewise, the fire that ruins their lodgings appears to be fortuitous. At the same time, we never learn whether the fire was due to human negligence, a product of arson, and hence a property crime, or entirely haphazard, accidental. And the servants could have plotted their actions for some time. Even gambling, the ultimate jeu de hasard, appears ambiguous in the novel, as the card-sharping experiences of Des Grieux are set within the context of the professionalization of cheating, of cheaters who organize themselves in a ligue de l'industrie. In other words, chance appears to be partially perspectival and very relative. The linguistic practices of the two nobles, the narrator Renoncourt and the Chevalier des Grieux, have much to tell us about the role played by both language and affect in asserting and maintaining social difference. Aristocratic language in Manon Lescaut, laden with metaphors and classical references, works towards stabilizing subjects into exemplars. The rhetoric of exemplarity sets the tone for much of the characterization of the novel, positing a veil onto the concrete dimension of existence. Abstractness functions as a strategic ideological response to the vagaries of the referential world. The Salpêtrière hospice used in the 18th century for the detention of prostitutes is designated, for example, via periphrasis. Manon is described as, by Des Grieux, menée dans une retraite que j'ai horreur de nommer. The derealization of their existence is one of the effects of Des Grieux's perspective. It bespeaks a certain will to distance oneself from materiality, as when Des Grieux insists that Manon is a chimiste magique qui transforme tout en or. For Manon, however, the reverse is operative. Material realities condition and possibilize affect. Crois-tu qu'on puisse être bien tendre lorsqu'on manque de pain? For Manon, the experience of material lack closes off the possibility of experiencing sentiment. In the noble destined for the Ordre de Malte des Grieux case, the usage of language as filter draws attention to what he calls his own éloquence scolastique, a casuistic instrument designed to draw the empathy of others. Des Grieux can hence fall into rogue behavior, lying, cheating, even committing murder, yet his language maintains the same elevated register all throughout his travails and allows for shared suffering, a suffering felt by like-minded, i.e. noble auditors, such as Renoncourt. Indeed, language is presented as a direct expression of a class sensibility, a byproduct of cultural refinement and exposure to délicatesse. It is a key tool in maintaining credit in what Avner Offer has termed an economy of regard, an economy where a good reputation is a coveted commodity. Des Grieux insists that he feels more acutely and experiences varied emotions because of his nobility. As a consequence, his superiority is expressed internally rather than through deeds. He benefits, therefore, from a type of emotional capital. He masters the ability to sustain and attract the reader's attention. Social difference is hence ultimately almost reducible to a linguistic performance. Thank you.